This is an interview with Lee Brackett Hamilton held in her home in Kinsman, Ohio on October 7th, 1975 at approximately 10:30 in the morning, conducted by Juanita Roderick and Professor Earnhardt.
Well, my father came from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and he died when I was just a baby in the flu epidemic in World War I. My mother and her family came from St. Louis, Missouri. I was the first generation native Californian, which in those days was quite rare, which is not anymore. I had a very happy childhood. I grew up at the beach. My grandfather was a father to me, and we had a very close relationship. Had a very happy time of it as a youngster, and rather a haphazard education because we moved around a good bit. That is, my grandfather didn't put my mother vibrating between him and her aunt and uncle. So that part of the time I was living in San Francisco, and then they had a fair bit of money, and we traveled with them. I think she was more or less a companion to my great aunt. And so I was fortunate enough to see a good bit of the country, rather more than most children do. And tripped down through the Panama Canal and New York and up to New England and Virginia, quite a bit of travel. And at the age of 8, I was always a great reader. I learned to read when I was about 5, I think, and haven't stopped since. Somebody gave me a copy of, or somehow I got hold of, a copy of Edgar Rice Burroughs' The Gods of Mars, and I was never the same after that. Suddenly we became aware of other worlds out there, and I guess right from then, from that time on, I was destined to be a science fiction writer. But nothing apart from that very fascinating happened. Just more or less normal
child. Yeah, brothers and sisters.
No, I was an only child. And my mother never remarried. For some reason, she was a beautiful woman. I don't know why, but she never did.
Can you tell us something about your school days from elementary school and then on into your...
I went to a little private school in Santa Monica. My mother was a segregationist. She didn't want me to be with boys. So I always went to a girls' school. And then she was quite ill for several years, and she kept me out of school for 4 years. So that, by the time I got around to being college age, I was offered a scholarship, but I was not able to go because by this time I had to get to work and, you know, were a little bit shy on money. So I had started to write quite seriously when I was 13. I decided right then I would be a writer because obviously this was a really easy way to make a living. All you had to do was sit down and write stories. And 10 years later I sold the first one. That was the end of 1939. It was published in 1940. And I tried writing almost everything, and finally decided that I would stick to science fiction because that's what I wanted to do, even though there wasn't very much money in it, and everybody warned me you'll starve to death. And it's not a very respectable field, you know, I mean, only nutcases write for it, and only nutcases read it. Now, things have changed since then, but in those days, it was not a, you know, my aunt used to say, why don't you write nice stories for the Ladies' Home Journal? And I would say, well, I wish I could because they pay awfully well, but I can't read the Ladies' Home Journal, and I'm quite sure I couldn't write for it. So there we were. And I did have a knack for science fiction, which I dearly loved. So for quite a while, I wrote nothing but science fiction, and then, but I was never a quantity producer, and it was a very small field. And in as much as I had some financial responsibilities, I had to broaden out, so I took to writing detective stories, and I wrote quite a few for the pulp magazines. And one last I wrote a novel, which was a frightful book, but it set my world on fire, but I loved it. It was my child, my firstborn full-length novel, and that it was published, and Howard Hawks read it. A friend of mine, I was at Martindale's bookstore, shoved it. He came in every couple of weeks and bought an armload of thrillers, and my friend saw two of them lined out in the pile. And a few days later, my agent rang me up and said, Howard Hawks wants to see you, whereupon I fell on the floor and went over to Warner Brothers for an interview and started to work on The Big Sleep, and was under contract with Howard for 2.5 years, I think.
for a woman, probably, at that time. Or didn't you feel that?
Well, I never felt it. You see, I don't know. I guess I was liberated on the day I was born, because my mother was a tremendously feminine, helpless sort of little person. And all the women in my family were professional ladies with a capital L, and a lady never did anything for herself. Somebody always did it for her. I mean, you know, and they looked down upon me with great scorn because I was vaguely husky and active and was always running up and down the beach and playing with the boys and you know, doing things. And my, oh, goodness, I got so many lectures. I think I was just the opposite type, that's all. And possibly became even more opposite because I so despised this attitude. Oh, it was ridiculous. And the idea that you were supposed to sit around waiting for some man to come along and want you and provide you with this, that, and the other. And I thought, I don't need anybody to provide me. I'll provide myself, you know. Because, you know, look, my mother and my father barely loved each other, and they were wonderful people, and they got married, and he died. And so where was she? You know, I mean, I've always preferred to have a little, you know, something in my own hands that I have control of. And it just so happened. Now, everybody says, how did it feel to be the first woman to crack the science fiction field, which was almost exclusively masculine? Well, my answer is I was not the first woman at all. There was Frances Stevens, who was writing science fiction for Argosy long before. And then there was Catherine Seale Moore, who was writing science fantasy for Weird Tales before I did. And there never was the slightest opposition. I got stories turned down because they were bad stories. And editors said, you know, I can't buy your story because it's terrible, learn to write better. But they never said, I won't buy your story because you're a woman. And they knew perfectly well I was. And as soon as I got to the point where I could write stories, you know, that would sell, they'd want them. And there was a little dust up and sometimes in the readers' columns in the magazines that said, you know, a woman can't write a decent science fiction story. And I said to myself, oh, pish, why not? And actually, what they were complaining about was not that a woman was writing it, but that the woman didn't know how to write it. When I learned a little better how to write, then I didn't get so many complaints. But actually, everybody in the field welcomed me with open arms, all the other writers and the editors and everybody. They were just, you know, because we were such a small, clubby group in those days. But if you found another nutcase that you could talk to, we were so busy talking about the War and Ouroboros and the Lensman series and all these things, you know, and everybody on the outside was saying, why do you want to waste your time on that childish dribble? And the spaceships indeed, ha, what would they push against? And so we just, you know, fell on each other's necks, and it was another one in the club, and there was never any feeling of discrimination there at all. Except one writer whose works I began to displace in one particular magazine, and he kept writing very gentlemanly letters about ladies were delicate little flowers, you know, and should be taken out and given wine and champagne and roses and so on, but they shouldn't write science fiction. I realized there was sort of personal motive there. I didn't find out until later, actually, if he'd been writing them, because, of course, he wrote those under a different name, and then somebody told me, which I thought was very funny. But, then when I started to write these hard-boiled detective stories for the like Dime Mystery, Flynn's Detective Weekly, and so on, which were also masculine markets, and no problem, they bought them, and they, you know, made no secret of my sex, and there's never any complaints, because I was writing what they wanted to buy.
You mentioned that when you became a better writer, it kind of came naturally to you, would you say?
No, it did not at all. I had really to fight and struggle. I, like most new writers, I think, I, at least in, anyway, I did. I overwrote dreadfully. I never used one adjective when 10 would do. And this was something I had to learn, was to blue pencil. And the editors were very patient with me and would, you know, tell me what to do when I did it. Construction, now Ed was always magnificent on construction. His style was in his early years was very cranky, but construction, he always knew the last word of the story before he wrote the first one. As for plot, and plot was always a great mystery to me, and if I tried to do an outline, I killed the story dead. You know, I had to feel it, and if I, like Byron said, you know, when he wrote a poem, if I miss my pounce, I go rumbling back to the thickets like an old tiger, and I had more half stories because I'd written myself into a box and couldn't get out of it. I had no idea where I was going. And learning how to construct a story was a long and painful process. And it was hit or miss at the beginning, which was one reason that I didn't sell more than I, you know, I could have sold more if I had known what I was doing, but it took me a long time to learn. The characters and the background and the color and everything were more important to me than the bones of the thing, and it was a long time before I could see the bones without killing me, the flesh.
Did you write on a regularly structured and scheduled basis, or as the spirit moved you?
I wrote every bloody morning as many words as I could write, and I often wrote in the evening, and while I was working on my novel, I wrote pulp in the morning for money, for 1 2 cents a word. Sense if I was lucky, and then I wrote work on the novel at night. You know, at first when I got to working in the studio, and that was a day's work, you know, you checked in at 9:30 and out at 5:30, and that was it.
Would you care to tell us something about your association with the studios in Hollywood in terms of writing, anything that you recall?
I was very fortunate, I think, because I was never under contract to a studio. Now, I was under contract personally to Howard Hawks, Charles Goldman on the Paycheck Productions, which was dissolved about 2.5 years later, and I got dissolved along with it. I never had to go through the business of checking in and checking out and all that. I came in for Misaki, he had his own bungalow, I worked only for him. Whereas so many of the people who were under contract in the studio or lived in sort of the barracks, and they were checked in and checked out, and of course that's all changed now. But you walk by the gate and they check you in at 9:30, and you better not be late, and you better not be caught leaving before 5:30 in the afternoon, which of course is absolutely ridiculous because nobody writes that many hours in a day.
And what was a typical day like when you were writing for the studio?
Well, a typical day would simply be that you got to the office and sat down and started to write, and you wrote as many pages as you could get out. And, always a fairly long break for lunch, and I had an awful lot of people at the Warner's commissary had what they called a green room, which was where us intermediates, us middle-class people went. The executives had their own dining room, and we had the green room, and then the lesser folk had a much larger place on the other side with sort of long trestles, and Hank and Catherine Kuttner were working there at the same time I was when I went back out many years later, and they said, we feel that they've put give them trenchers and wooden bowls, you know, over where the peasants are. But now, Warner Brothers is one of the few studios that did that. Paramount, the commissary, is all in one. But anyway, we had the writer's table. And so this was beautiful because I was so green and I was, you know, very much in awe. And I'm, you know, this is my first really time out in the big world. And I met Christopher Isherwood and John Collier, and Stephen Longstreet, and William Faulkner. Of course, I worked with William Faulkner on The Big Sleep. And that is to say, we worked in adjoining offices. We didn't work together at all. So I met a very fascinating lot of people, Barry Lyndon, the playwright, who was working as a writer, screenwriter. The talks, he would sit you down for a couple of days and give you his ideas, and then he'd go away, and you wouldn't see him again for weeks, months, until he decided there was a start date and he was going to go with a picture, and then you worked your tail off. And that's always been the pattern for him. So it was not really typical of most studio jobs. Now, the one small job I had before then was over at Republic, and that was, I worked a week and a half on the treatment, and I was teamed up with a writer who knew what he was doing. This was my first job, and Johnny Butler, who was one of the old Black Mask crew, and they did the script in 3 weeks. And they shot the picture in 10 days, and that was 2 days over schedule. But of course, those were the days when there was plenty of money, and Howard Hawks was always his own boss. He was an independent who would make a deal with a studio, to use their facilities, and there would be financing and so on, but he was absolute complete boss. I never had to answer to anybody else, and this was very helpful.
You know, many of the stars of that era complained very bitterly about the tremendous pressure and the way they were used, and of course, those of us who were Judy Garland fans, you know, kind of have a sour taste if those things really did happen, we sort of resent it. Did the writers feel the same kind of pressure and the being used type thing?
They either felt that or else they felt neglected, depending on the situation. And there was a script that had been kicking around Warner Brothers for a number of years, and when a writer, a contract writer, would find the script on his desk as his next assignment, he knew that the pink slip was coming up in about 1 week, because nobody could solve this, then it gave them a chance to, you know, to boot them out. They were kind of an unhappy crew, really. They were making tremendous pots of money, and most of them were, I think, were not pressured too hard on the work, but the usual feeling of frustration and things get kind of, you know, you start out with a beautiful idea and it gets lost. And there are so many other elements that enter into it. I really couldn't say, as I said, I was not in the writer's building. And I didn't have too much conversation with them on that score. I know both Isherwood and Collier were working on Wilkie Collins things, a woman in white and then Tombstone. Forget which one was working on which. I don't think either picture was ever produced. Yeah, this gets to be, and I know my friends the Kuttners were there, and they adored their producer, who was a nice man, but they were pressured to do this thing. What was it, Rappaccini's daughter?
Yep.
And there were considerable story problems with that, and they were just working away like little beavers, and then the whole project was canceled. And, you know, there's a feeling of not being very sure, and this is one reason I've never given up writing fiction, because when you write fiction, you don't have to wait for somebody to ask you to do it and pay you to do it. You just sit down and do it, and if you're any reasonable amount of a professional, you're pretty darn sure you'll sell it somewhere. Now, there isn't as much money by any manner of means, but you make a living at it, and you are your own man. Whereas in the studios, you're always between heaven and earth. Of course, you can sit down and write an original screenplay on your own time and hope to sell it. And I did that, and it's still out. That was how many years ago now? I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And we're still hoping to sell it, but, you know, we've been right up to the top with it, and just, you know, all you had to do was sign the contracts, and then at the last minute, boom.
Did you ever have an experience where someone stole your idea and took credit for some of your ideas?
I'm sure it's done, but I've never happened to have it done to me, except in the sense that, now, Ed's had it done many times. The older science fiction writers have had it done many times, because they would originate. See, Ed originated so many things. It was a much smaller field then, and, you know, like the spacesuit. I mean, he was the first one to write a story about people who put on spacesuits and went outside of the ship in space. Well, many another concept in science fiction that now the younger ones come in and they take this all as public domain, you see, and they, so to a certain, I've had stories of mine lifted practically, you know, they hardly even bother to change the names in science fiction, and I suppose this is, you know, the sincerest form of flattery, but you do get a little annoyed, you wish they could, but in the films, I don't think I ever have had.
You mentioned earlier you had an agent. What is the role of an agent when you were beginning a career in writing? Did you lean on him for many things, or is he a necessary tool which one cannot do without?
In the field of fiction, one can do without, but it's much better to have an agent. I see, I lived on the West Coast, and I was selling stories in New York. And my then agent, who was both our agents, and or agent for both of us, I should say, and still a very dear friend, even though he's been out of the agency business for a long time, Jerry Schwartz. He's one of the top men at National Comics now. And they're right on the spot. They know who has a need for a story in those days, and they can take it around and submit it and send you back the editorial comments and tell you. Very often, he'd send back a story and say, this just isn't good enough, try again or do this and such to it. He was very useful to me, very useful. I worked for a while with Allen agent later on because he really quit and got a job. By this time, I'm sufficiently established in the science fiction field, and also, you can sell novels. You don't have to have an agent. There are so many things you can't do for yourself now, much more than then. There are all the foreign markets, you see, which often pay you as much or more as your domestic markets, because it's a continuing thing. I've just signed contracts for 3 books in Japan, a Japanese publisher. Well, I don't know Gangan Shop. I'm a hole in the ground. I only know the name, but an agent who has connections all over the world can make many sales for you that you would not make yourself. So I have a literary agent in New York. Now, in Hollywood, it's a different matter. You don't work without an agent, because unless you have an agent, you don't get interviews, they don't come to you, they come to the agent. Unless you're all personal friends, then they'll ring you up and say, would you like to do so-and-so and get in touch with Ned, and they will not accept in the studios, they would never accept for a very long time any unsolicited manuscript, scenario, screenplay. For a very simple reason, they got sued too many times, they won't even open them. So you have to have an agent there. Also, from the business standpoint, you have to have an agent because you can't go in and fight for yourself on money. You'd be working for a guild base for the rest of your life if it was left up to the, to them.
What is the fee that he accepts through the years? How has it changed?
In my time, it hasn't changed at all. They passed a law in California many years ago that an agent cannot, this is a state law, as well as now, it has been a guild regulation, and there's some jockeying back and forth on packaging and stuff, which is out of my ken. But flat 10%, and they cannot take more than 10%. Because in the very early days, some of the agents were unscrupulous, and they were taking, 50 and 60 and 70%. And this goes also for agents for actors and producers, and not only for writers. And it's always been 10%. for a literary agency in New York.
As you reflect on, shall I use the word, the quality of science fiction, and I don't know from a writer's viewpoint if that is a correct word, how has it changed, your field changed from the early days?
Well, it's become much more literary. In the early days, the stories had, to my mind, this is probably heresy, but I think the earlier stories were better. I'm sure that if I were 8 or 8 years old now and reading Harlan Ellison, for instance, I wouldn't get the thrill, and the charge that I got out of Edgar Rice Burroughs. The people who wrote science fiction in the early days wrote it not for money, because there wasn't any, practically speaking, but for love, because they absolutely adored the field and they had these tremendous bursting imaginations. And the stories had so much more vigor and excitement than they have now. Of course, there was some, terrible stuff done, admittedly, but there were some just great stories and great ideas and great, it was all very, now, since so many, it's become a much broader field, and it's respectable now, and they teach it in the universities. The people coming to it are, on the whole, better writers in the sense that they have a smoother style and from the literary standpoint. But they have taken to instead of going outward to the stars, which was to me always a great thrill in the strange worlds and the, you know, shooting the nebula and getting lost in the horse head or the coal sack or, you know, on the drowned suns and the burning in the dark nebula and all this, you know, this was what just sent me skyrocketing. Now they all do this, you know, the inner world stuff of Freudian psychology and, you know, sort of grotty sex, and I'm not saying it ought not to be done, but I'm saying it doesn't have the same excitement for me that the older stuff did.
Do you think that spark of imagination and creativity can be imparted to a child or cultivated, or do you think some of it's inherited? Some children seem to be more imagined than others. What are you?
I don't really know. My father was a frustrated writer. He made his living as a CPA, but long after his death, I came across, long after I had become a writer myself, I knew that he had written things because my mother told me. He was trying very hard to sell stories to the films in those early days. And I found quite a batch of his things and short treatments and story ideas and so on, and I was working on a story called The Dancing Girl of Ganymede, and I picked up one of his. It was called The Dancing Girl of Cadiz. I thought, well, you know, the more it changes, the more it's the same thing. But he had a good pulp writer's mind, I can tell you. You know, the plots were good and the ideas were good, and so perhaps I got that from him. I don't know. He died too young, and of course he married, and he had a wife and child, and he didn't have the time to take to write. But I don't think we're particularly noted for literary people in my family. Way back in the 15th century, there was a Gavin Douglas, Samuel Douglas on my mother's side, who translated the Bible into Scottish, Gaelic, I think. But as far as I know, that's the only literary light there's been on either side.
Whole question of imagination and creative thought intrigues me.
Well, it's a delicate little spark, and it can so easily be crushed out if conditions aren't right. It's like any little seed that's dropped into the ground, but, you know, it's got to have a place where it can grow. Now, some people seem to have a much more, I was fortunate, my grandfather subsidized me until I had begun to sell. Otherwise, I would have had to get a job, and I might never have had the time or the energy left over to develop as a writer. And I think this may happen to quite a few people. On the other hand, I think if the urge is strong enough, they'll overcome that one way or another, because many of them have, you know, that have had to work as dishwashers and you name it, to make a living. And still they've had this tremendous urge to do it, which I assume would be the sort of music. Usually if a musician doesn't show the talent by the time he's 5 or 6 years old, he isn't going to have it. But writing seems to be able to develop. Well, Chastain was 50, I think, when he began to write. And Burroughs was 50. Edgar Rice Burroughs was 50 or over when he began. Everybody's different. I don't even, it's difficult to pin down.
I keep thinking about the possibility of canned entertainment, television, or out there, the packaged form of entertainment compared to my childhood when you had to think of your own way to entertain yourself during the Depression.
When we were youngsters, the last thing we wanted was to be supervised and have older people telling us what to do. We just wanted to get off by our little selves and do what we wanted to do, provided it wasn't vandalism or, you know, something we ought not to do. Not that we were all the little angels, but of course we were taught in those days a lot more respect for other people's property, I think, than kids have now. It never occurred to me to break somebody's windows, or, you know, I'd have been punished too harshly. I wouldn't have enjoyed it. And anyway, this was just instilled into me, and taboo, you don't touch. And but we thought up our own games.
Packaged and parts are labeled and all that. Wonder about losing something in children.
Mm-hmm. I think you do. I think they should be encouraged to think for themselves and imagine for themselves.
someone were to ask you what advice to give to a young writer, what kind of advice would you give that writer?
Well, the only possible advice is if you want to write, write. And write whatever you want to write. And keep at it, because, as I say, it took me 10 years. Of course, I started at 13. Well, 13, you don't know a blooming thing, you know. Of course, I wasn't a genius like Daisy Ashford or Marjorie Fleming, but it took me a little longer. But the ability, one of the things you have got to learn, and I have met people in the writing field, and I've met people in the acting field where it's even infinitely worse, who simply cannot take the least little bit of criticism or the least blow to their ego. You know, I mean, they cannot accept the fact that something they've done isn't good, and you must be able to do that, and it hurts. You don't like it. It is not pleasant, but you've got to be able to do it, otherwise you never become a professional, you never grow into the profession. I've seen girls just go into absolute hysterics, you know, because the director said, look, you're not doing the scene right. Well, and they weren't. And they were, you know, like 19 or 20, and obviously they didn't know the whole business, and you simply got to learn. And so many writers, that they wouldn't dream of revising a story, heavens. You know, it'd be like chopping their head off to try and get them to do it. And this is, you know, you can't do it. Then, you know, there's the talented amateur, and then there's the professional. And you never make that jump until you learn to accept the painful kicks in the teeth that you get along, and the discouragement, and the fact that, Lord Almighty, your markets fall in on you. You know, because we wrote pulp for so many years, and we knew everybody, and, you know, we had no problem, and then the pulp magazines are gone. And presently the slick magazines are gone as well. And I know some pretty unhappy and disoriented people out there who made a fat living writing for the Saturday Evening Post, and now they're trying to do television, and they're trying to do films, and it's a whole new world, and they're, you know, completely lost. And you are going to get lumps and bumps all the way along the road. And, you know, you just have to be able to ride with them. Some people get horribly discouraged, and, you know, they want to cut their throats or quit writing, or they get terribly resentful about people who are still working or able to, you know, get over these humps and very negative attitudes, which is fatal.
You still write frequently now, too, Mrs. Downey?
I'm writing frequently and like mad. I'm working.
So we really are intruding on some valuable time.
You catch me at a bad moment. I'm doing a...
Broke right into your
working
mood.
On a television pilot. Pilot script for a new series. And I was ill this summer, and I wasn't able to get back out there, so I'm doing it here. And I have just got two acts done, and I think, isn't that nice? You know, I'm going to be on schedule. They want the thing in 3 weeks. We've got the treatment okay with the network. And so last night, my little producer brings me up and says, you know, throwing everything into it. I said, if you don't stop calling me up and making me revise Act One, you're never going to get this thing.
We broke right into her act, didn't we?
So now I'm trying to compress two fairly long acts into one, because the cliffhanger's got to come at the end of Act One and not the end of Act Two. You see, this is something you run into. That's not the way, you don't write it the way it ought to be written, but the way it has to be written. Try and make the two things come together.
Speaking of television, you know, there has been a sudden flurry or an interest awakened in obviously with the space programs and so on. How do you see such weekly features of Star Trek, the special that they did, you know, did man from outer space come to the Earth, you know, and leave his mementos behind in various places of South America and so on and so on? How do you react to that?
Well, I'm all for it. I think science fiction, right down through the years, has been very valuable in providing the general, the reading public, and with the idea that these things are possible. So many of the people in NASA and many of the astronauts were science fiction readers in their youth, and this gives you the idea that these things might be or can be, that there's a possibility the concept is there. We had to wait for the engineers to come along and do it, actually. And then, of course, when Sputnik went up, now that was the cutoff right there, because then everybody had to admit that it was possible. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was a good bit of panic around almost among non-science fiction readers who kept looking up there and saying, but what could be looking down at us, you know, that's making a hole in the sky and something might go start looking in. And I've gotten over that now, but now this, oddly enough, I hadn't thought, but the question was brought up at a seminar out in California this spring, and twice as many women had suddenly got into come into the field. And Kate Wilhelm said, well, after Sputnik went up, you know, and it all became real, and we realized that, you know, so many things were happening in the world, and we just had to get in. Well, that's fine. I was in a long time before it was real, because I, you know, it was just the idea of the thing that fascinated me, but the reality apparently brought, so that there's no longer any need to tell them that space is space flight is possible. I think what they need to be told now is that it's necessary, because everybody, you keep hearing this crud about all the money that's going into the space program just to put a man on the moon, as though that was all of it and the end of it. Scientists, any technician, any physician, any surgeon will tell you that the knowledge that has come out of the space program already, the fallout from it, miniaturization of circuitry and so on, and things that they found out medically, will more than pay for it. You know, and benefits to the general public, but the general public, of course, and some of our myopic politicians don't choose to see that. So, as far as I'm concerned, the more science fiction they put on television, and the more they do, you know, to keep the idea in front of the public, the better.
No doubt, you followed all the NASA adventures.
Oh yes, we were down there for the Apollo 12 shot. Through Esther, we were accredited to the Youngstown Vindicator, and we were in the press box. Oh my, that was a thrill. Uh-huh.
That was my question, you know, as you watch this develop, you know, and things that you may have thought about or written about or hinted at in your various stories, now suddenly there it happens.
Well, I think this has been the biggest thrill for both of us, because we labored in these vineyards when it was, you know, and took many a sneer and so on.
The old Buck Rogers thing.
That's right. And then everybody said, ha, 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 how stupid, you know. I remember having a terrible fight with my grandfather when I was about 8 years old, and I said, I want to be on the first rocket ship that goes to Mars, the first ship that goes to Mars. And he said, there will never be a ship go to Mars. And I said, but why? And he said, well, there's nothing out there but space. What would it push against? It's impossible. And at age 8, I didn't know what it would push against either, but I remember stamping my foot and saying, but it will, I know it will, and I think this has been the greatest thrill for both of us to see this actually happen in our lifetimes. I don't think either one of us thought that it would occur, really, in our own lifetime. We were positive it would occur sometime, but we were just both delighted that we were around when the first step did happen.
I'm going to ask you a strange question about a strange phenomenon. What is your opinion of UFOs?
We have an open mind on that. You can dismiss 90% or 95% of it as delusion or crackpot.
Publicity getting
nutcases, where we actually met a flying saucer, and a perfectly charming, well-educated gentleman, just as crazy as a hatter. But there's a small percentage of these sightings that just won't go away. And so we're just waiting. Of course, we have to fight against the idea that maybe one will land right in our meadow down there and we'll be the first ones to welcome the Martians or whoever, you know, because we want it to be. So therefore, we have to push it off. But I think it's not at all unlikely that people are sort of sending probes and having a look at us.
Do you subscribe then to that theory that there is a window out there in the space that is a corridor that sort of provides one an avenue to travel around?
Do you mean to an alternate universe, or, mm-hmm. or this is beyond me. We've got enough in this universe right now. When the astronauts, or that is when they speak of a window or a corridor for a launch, they're talking about a physical thing.
Yeah.
You know, when the other planet is in the proper position in its orbit. I think with all the, of course, we're way out in one of the spiral arms. We're very small, little pebble, and a few little dust motes spinning around it, and who knows, farther in toward the center of the galaxy where there are so many more suns, and there could be a tremendous star-traveling civilization there for all we know. We've never come across it, unless they would come in and find us. And perhaps they don't want to make contact, perhaps they're not interested. Heaven knows, I don't know. It's just, you know, because we've written, speculated, and written stories from all angles, it is and it isn't, you know, up, down, and sideways. So, I don't think it's in the least bit impossible.
Mrs. Hamilton, since I'm interested in telling children about you, hopefully, what could you tell me to tell them about letting dream their dreams and that sort of thing? In other words, you said you had playmates, you weren't necessarily a loner. It isn't necessarily the loner who spins daydreams who becomes a writer. There's something that...
I was both. I think Ed and I were very much alike in that, because we had our little friends and we played with them, but then we had a life that was apart from that, because most of these kids were not great readers. And they couldn't follow me where I went, you know, in books. And some of the happiest times, of course, I was fortunate. I grew up at the beach, which in those days was a very lonely place. And very few, you know, there were other houses. I don't mean we were isolated, but we were only a mile or so from town. But there was an awful lot of empty beach, and I remember one of the happiest things I used to do as a child was to walk out to the end of the jetty and sit on the stringer with my feet in the ocean, and just listen to the breathing of the sea and look out at the horizon and just feel and think. And I love being alone.
How long would you sit there?
Oh, until I got cold. and I don't think any of the other kids ever did that, and I don't know whether they did or not, but I never encountered them doing it. So there may be something in the loner. I think you have to be, in other words, you have to be enough of an individual yourself, otherwise nothing that individual is going to come out of you. And a lot of kids, a lot of people that I've known who are extremely bright, intelligent, able, make a success of their lives, are not oriented toward books, a technical book, something that can get something out of. But they never read fiction, or hardly ever read fiction. They don't go to the movies much. They didn't even when the movies were pretty good. This just is not part of their camp. And there's no reason why it should be, but I mean, these people are never going to be writers. If you have the the instinct and you're drawn to these things, or if you're drawn to painting or to music or any of these things, you should be allowed and encouraged to go that way. Some people I know try to, because they don't think it's a good living, or they don't want the kid to get into that particular kind of a life, they try to stifle it sometimes. But to a certain extent, I think everybody has to be a loner, because if you're just a community thing, then you're like a jellyfish, or you're watching the cells of all.
Oh, we're bombarded by noise all the time, getting to an elevator and it's music or noise or anything. It seems that
people are afraid to be alone.
Culture that, you know, people want to be in crowds, and you know, it's they want to be in in the big city, and yet they look about and create a Boardman and all in Toronto and Liberty, which is just as crowded, you know. They're not like a Daniel Boone, you know, who's anybody within 10 miles, 10 miles too close.
Right.
And they want to move.
But it's the pressure to conform. You've got to conform, and it starts the day a kid enters school. You've got to be like 25 others in the class. Too much so. You don't dare to be different, really. There was a book written once by, I'm sure not a very famous author, but anyway, it was entitled, I believe, Where Are You Going Out? What Are You Doing? Nothing. It was written by someone of my vintage. And you saw a kid lying out there in your meadow looking up at the sky. Well, the parents were taken to the nearest child guidance clinic. There was a kid analyzed. That's not like we live anymore. That's strange and weird.
Socially expected. I think this is
true. Anybody really has time to think anymore. They're bombarded by so many external stimuli. And it's like you're going to sit down and have it given to you. In college, in the 10 years I've been there, that you entertain me, you know, I'm not going to reach them in the I don't know. That sense of resourcefulness is not to be cultivated anymore.
What type of education would one draw upon for become a writer in the science fiction field?
Well, most of the science fiction writers were scientifically. I mean, they were in some. They got their master's in science. They've worked in some related job. They know a whale of a lot more science than I do because you could put in a teaspoon. Ed was you were going to be an electrical engineer. Majored in physics and chemistry and whatnot. I took physics and chemistry, like everybody does in high school. I can't write hard science stories. I never could, which is one reason I sold 3 stories to Campbell of Astounding, the first 2 I ever sold and one later on. And then I gave up because he liked a different type of story, and we just, I don't know why he bought those 3 really to begin with. They weren't that good, and they weren't particularly his type of thing, but I don't know enough about ramjets and all these things to, you know, to write that type of story. Whereas Ed does, Larry Newton does, Jerry Purnell, all these people that are PhDs or scientists of one sort or another themselves, and they have the background, and that's fine. I don't know mine, I think, just from the title, when I was in, I think, about the seventh or eighth grade, they gave us Breasted the Ancient World, and I became an ancient history buff right then. Anything about prehistoric man or, you know, Babylonia, Assyria, Egypt, you know, it's just all fascinating. I've read a fair bit of astronomical material, and I've grown up pretty well before I write something so that I won't do something absolutely stupid, and I try to just, you know, fake around it so that it looks good, but we don't get right into the heart of the computer and tell exactly how those little relays work. We just assume that the reader knows what a computer is and go on. And Ray Bradbury knows, I think, even less science than I do. He once wrote a story called Golden Apples of the Sun, where the cold got colder and colder and thousands of degrees below zero, you know, thus and such, and somebody wrote and said, Ray, did you ever hear of absolute zero? There's a point below which it don't go. No, he never heard of that. So it hasn't hurt his career particularly. It just depends on what type of thing you're oriented toward and what you like to write. Mine I suppose you would call the soft science of anthropology, and I delight in creating worlds and building civilizations, and I always want to know how the people eat, what crops they grow, what kind of houses they live in, where they get the building materials, you know, do they build with mud brick, or do they build with wood or stone or what, and all these things working together, fascinating.
Well,
Is there anything else that you would like to share with us about your career?
Well, I will say one thing about science fiction, that it is unique in that we are a very friendly and clubby group, and anywhere you go in the world, there are science fiction clubs. And if the science fiction people know that you are coming, they will roll out the red carpet for you. We landed in Australia, in Sydney, and they carried us around in their hands for a week, and we had a simply marvelous time. They have friends wherever you go. Even you go to England, you know, and you're invited here, and you're taken there, and you get to meet all these lovely people. And this is a very rewarding thing. Nearly all our photographers, I met my husband, and most of our friends, actually, that we've had all our lives, are in the science fiction field.
Is that unusual?
Well, I think it is in the other writing fields, because the glue that holds it together is the fans. And there isn't a fan group in any other field. I mean, there's millions of people read Westerns, millions of people read detective stories. I belong to the Western Writers of America, who gave me a very handsome prize once for a novel. I used to belong to the Mystery Writers and go to meetings, and you meet a lot of fabulous people there, and it's fascinating, a lot of fun. But they don't have the conventions every year. The fan groups put on a convention, a world convention every year, and then there are little regional gatherings, and it's like a big family.
Is there a group or a club in this area at all?
I don't think there's one. There's one in Cincinnati. There's a tremendously influential one. In fact, they're doing a little gathering up at Sandusky in a week from Friday. And they have what they call the Midwest Con, and which is in June, and it's small affair. It's been getting too big the last few years because too many people have been coming, but it used to be just kind of a small family group, and a grand bunch of people, and you go and have parties, and you chin around, and you talk, and they never have a formal program. Some of the others put on more elaborate ones, and there are programs, panels, seminars, banquets, all that stuff, and then there's the big one. The last one I went to was in Washington. This year it was in Australia, and it was not possible to go, and I enjoyed it. Next year it's going to be in Kansas City, I think. But now the Trekkies have come along. Now that's just a totally separate group.
The
Trekkies. Yeah, you were talking about Star Trek.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, and this is a phenomenon because the program went off, as you know, off the air 7 years ago. But it has spawned a tremendous mob of fans, and they seem to be a little, some of them kind of borderline cases, but they come out in the thousands. Wearing their Spock ears, and their little antennae.
They're replaying it again.
I know, it's on
television.
It's in syndication.
Yeah.
And they're doing a Saturday morning television, cartoon version of it. And there's some talk that they're going to do a feature film. But even the people who did Star Trek have been absolutely astounded because they put on these Star Trek conventions, which are not... They're separate totally from the science fiction convention. They're a whole different group. Although we have Star Trek material and a certain number of Trekkies come to the regular conventions, but they come out in the thousands. They have to turn them away because the fire department says you can't have any more people in this hotel.
Well, it's no worse than the Mickey Mouse clubs. Everybody walking around in big
yeah,
ears in California, and the the people who jam the Aragon Ballroom every Saturday night to hopefully dance with Lawrence Welk,
mm-hmm.
And the world's big enough for us all.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure.
Hugh, can you think of anything that we overlooked?
Might ask one question. Where do you see science fiction writing going to into the 21st century?
Well, that's very fascinating. Science has been breathing down the backs of our necks, of course. You have to keep one jump ahead of it. Because I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen to the world in that time. I don't know what's going to happen to, you know, what the economic situation is going to be, what the, you know, whether there's going to be a world then. As far as science fiction is concerned, I think that we'll probably stay around the way it's always done, that the innovators and there'll be people who follow along. I don't know. It's such a volatile field, and this is one reason it stayed alive, and one reason that it does attract some very brilliant and talented people is because it's never hardened into any particular form. It's never fossilized, and new ideas are always coming up in new directions. And I really couldn't make any prediction except that I'm sure whatever it does, it'll do it, and it'll be good. The new wave has kind of faded out now, and a few more people are getting back just writing stories. We had a tremendous new wave phase where everything was left hanging in midair, and it was all frightfully esoteric, and people would write in and say, so-and-so's story was absolutely great, I couldn't understand a word of it, you know. So they couldn't understand it, so they know it was magnificent.
Yeah.
It was a mark of quality, yes, right. You know, any idiot can write a story that you can understand, but it takes a genius to write one that you can't figure out any detail on.
Would you say that the current interest in astrology and the stars and all this has helped encourage the interest in science fiction?
I don't really think astrology has had too much to do with it. I think the main thing that has encouraged interest in science fiction is simply the fact that so much of it has come true and people are, you know, it's become real. Yeah, right. The astrology, most of the people in the science fiction business are pretty hard-headed scientists and pragmatists, and I don't think many of them go in much for that sort of mysticism. One of Ed's oldest friends and very, very dear friend is a professional astrologer, and he believes in it implicitly, and he says, no, I can't explain it, but if the bloody thing works, it works. So, all right, that's another thing I have an open mind on, I've always stayed away from it myself, but I don't think that just simply for that reason that it's had too much effect on me. I'm sure it's had effect on all the occult literature that's been coming out. That's had a tremendous resurgence in the last few years. The Exorcist and possession by the devil and all this stuff, and Daniken. I read Daniken's book. It was fascinating. But I want a little more proof before I hope for some of these things. But I myself would like to know what some of these strange constructions are and what they actually meant and what the people thought they were doing when they built them. And it's no new thought that the people came to Earth to teach. I mean, the legend of Oannes is as old as Babylon, or Babylonia, I mean, it's much older than Babylon. This has always fascinated us. Seems like so many people in Kukulkan who was came from somewhere and taught the Maya everything they knew. Well, you know, this goes on through a lot of ancient history, and it's perfectly simple to believe that a few people dropped in their spaceships, and also so many gaps in the prehistoric man, Cro-Magnon man, appeared suddenly, practically full-blown, like from where, you know, there's nothing leading up to him, he's just all of a sudden there. Well, of course, we probably haven't found the links, or they've been destroyed, or something, but it's an interesting speculation.
I keep saying one last question, something else crops up. You remember the two probably not well-educated police officers, I think it was in Mississippi or Alabama, who were captured and taken aboard the thing. And, you know, their story has been put to the test so many times from a variety of ways. Did a science fiction writer who, how did you see that story? And second, did you in your own mind try to put any of those things to the test that they had related as a possibility of might being true?
I'm not familiar with that particular case. I read the one about that occurred up at Exeter in Massachusetts, which was extremely fascinating. There have been so many of these things that apparently, you can't really doubt the people because they don't seem like the type. And of course, there have been sightings. I mean, when Clyde Tombaugh tells me he saw something, I believe him. I might not believe myself that I saw something, but I believe him because he knows what he's looking at. Airline pilots, and they caught something on a theodolite once that, and they caught them in their instruments, and they, so I'm pretty sure there's something out there. Now, actually, whether these people were taken into a spaceship and interviewed, I don't know. I have no way of proving one way or the other whether they did or not. So I just, it's easy enough to pull a hoax like that because there isn't really any way it can be disproved, unless you have witnesses who knew you weren't there or, unless you have negative evidence of some kind, which is very difficult to find.
Those type of things that are reported occasionally provide any kind of inspiration to hit the typewriter again.
We've both written stories about people who got involved with spaceships, and one of mine's being reprinted in January, and a fellow had a feeling and he just wasn't happy or comfortable, and he kept going back and trying to find the origins of his birth and so on, and tracked him back to Brittany and way out in the lands, and the spaceship came down. And this was all thoroughly well explained why nobody knew about it, so he was whipped aboard and passed his test as one of the star traveling race, the only one, and there we were off galloping away on our flock.
I thought you were going to say galloping away on a horse.
Ed wrote one about the fellow who was sprung out of jail from a small Midwestern town by a mysterious individual and discovered he was the ruler of a far-flung space empire, and was had been foully brainwashed and had his memory revoked and tucked away on this remote little planet. Well, there are all kinds of beautiful ways you can use it.
We always talk about writing, favorite phrase in the historical field, that we brought Thomas Jefferson to the dinner table with us for 4 years while we were laboring over a biography or something. Do you ever have the feeling that, you're sitting in the room here, or you sit down for lunch and there's these people who you've been talking about and describing, you've been thinking about it, and to write and make it come alive requires, just almost jumping on that page and rolling around with the typewriter and this type of thing. And, it's rare the person can close the door and walk out into another surrounding and forget that. You just don't pull window shades. Do you have any people come to dinner with you? Sit around out here in the meadows and
The mind is oddly compartmented that way. There's one part of it that's always working with the story that you're working on, and the people are always kind of there. And then there's the other compartment that says, "Gee, I got to get eggs, what am I going to have for dinner?" And it all seems to, it's just sort of separate tanks. I found that oftentimes if I get absolutely stumped on a story, I'm going to plot something that isn't working. Something just isn't working. Just forget it for 2 or 3 days, and all of a sudden, the subconscious will start popping it up to you.
But when it comes to the forefront, do you stick to that typewriter?
Oh, yeah.
Much more so than...
No, that's true. You carry these things around with you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Very often, you know, I'll get this sort of faraway look, and then it'll say, you're thinking, aren't you?
Do you try on your plots with each other?
Yeah.
That's not official collaborating.
Our marriage nearly broke up shortly after it began because I had an order for a novel from Starling Stories in the Standard Magazine. And I said, I think I have an idea for a plot. There was a whole $800, and boy, did we need it.
We had a lot of money on it.
What year was this?
This was 1947. We were married at the end of 46. This was 1947. And so I sat down with my little typewriter and wrote the opening, and I wrote two or three chapters, and I handed it to him, said, see what you think of this, and he read it, and he said, gee, this is great, where do you go from here? And I said, I have the faintest idea. He said, that is the so-and-so-and-so-and-so's way to write a story. Right there, we discovered we couldn't collaborate too well. So I went manfully on with it, and then I said, I think I'm getting into a little bit of trouble here, and he said, let me read it. So he read it, and he went back to chapter two and put in a Dubian, and Dubian being a strange alien character, so they went on the ship, and I could have killed him. The trouble was, he was right. You know, so all I did just throw out was like, yeah, let's go back and start over again.
Well, we really feel that it's been a privilege that you
I'm very flattered that you came all this way up here and spent the morning till night.
I just enjoyed it so much.
Hope it's been helpful to you.
Very. Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for giving
out
themselves like that.